The Mac Observer's Mac Geek App, episode 613 for Sunday, July 10th, 2016.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek App. The show where you send in all kinds of things. We share those things and many others. And the goal is together to learn, we raised the bar last week, four new things each and every time we get together. This episode is sponsored in part by Gazelle at gazelle.com. We'll talk more about them a little bit later here in Durham, New Hampshire, ostensibly. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here, indubitably, still... in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
So we are, as we mentioned in last week's show, we're actually recording this immediately. Well, not immediately after the 612. We took a short little break and actually played the folks on the live stream at macgeekgab.com/stream. The Fling, which is my band, one of the bands I play in, we just released an EP, Bovine Abduction, and we played that for everyone on the stream in the break. You can hear it streamed to you from Apple Music and Spotify and all that, and we'll put a link in the show notes. But so we're recording this well in advance. In fact, this is the most certainly the furthest in advance we've ever recorded an episode. And I am going to bring a mic with me on my travels, I think, John, just, you know, in case, I don't know, something, we could get a wild hair or something. But with that being recorded, you know, in advance, I figured let's slow the pace down a little bit and do a deep dive on a couple of things and see how that goes. And one of the things that many of you have been asking us about is Synology. So we're going to talk a little bit about that in a minute or in a couple of minutes. Actually, that's not the first topic we're going to talk about. We've got some talk about Powerline and replacements thereof for networking. We're going to talk a little bit about that. New Mac buying advice. You know, just we're going to take a little bit. And we may only do like four topics on the show. But, you know, I figured this would be a good opportunity to do that. And of course, as we know, things happen as soon as we seed a topic. Well, it tends to kind of come back in spades in terms of questions and that sort of thing. And that's great. So we're going to seed a couple new topics today if everybody's all right with that. Are you okay with that, Mr. Braun?
Yeah.
Let's jump to Yan. I'm not sure actually how he pronounces his name, Y-A-N-N, to get things started. He says, talking about, I'm going to read his whole note and we'll see where we go here. I think we'll all agree that Time Machine sucks. And I personally have experienced silent backup corruption where some critical system files were missing from the backup. When I needed it, my iMac wasn't bootable. I could figure things out in single user mode and copy missing files from another running system, but that's definitely not something a mere mortal would want to go through. The best thing about it, there's no way to check consistency of a Time Machine backup. As incredible as it sounds, Apple has no way to let users check their backups. It's true. Apple has no way to do that. You could do it, use a different tool, but it would actually be quite a bit of work to make that happen.
They let you verify the integrity of the sparse bundle, but that's not the same as making sure that the backup is actually an accurate representation.
No, you're right. The only way to check if a backup is an accurate representation is to do the backup and then do a comparison, making sure the files in the backup match the files that you just thought you copied to the backup. And that is a very slow and deliberate process, sort of by definition. I guess you could do a checksum on the whole thing, but still you've got to go read what you just backed up. You cannot trust that just because you wrote it, it succeeded. You have to go read it. That's called verification, right?
Yeah, you actually bring up an interesting point because we had a question suggesting something like this in the past. There are tools that will do, as Dave mentioned, so there's something called a checksum, which is basically something complex. Well, it's a complex calculation that is done on a blob of data, and you get this magic number which represents that blob of data. And so right. in theory, what you could do is
And hopefully uniquely represents that blob of data.
Yeah, and these are called hashes, one-way hashes, and typically that's the point of these functions, is that a simple version of a way to calculate this is to take the value of each byte and just add it up into a number. But that's bad because the potential for you to get a collision with data that isn't the same is very high. So they do, like, I think, you know, what the one that most people use is something called a CRC or cyclic redundancy check, and message digests or another thing. But anyways, there's a way to calculate a value. But as you pointed out, I mean, you got to look at every byte of data.
You have to
take
read
a
it.
Really. Yeah. I mean, if you're backing up gigs of data, then this could take a really long time to calculate that. And I've seen some programs that can do that on a file by file basis, or I guess on a whole blob. But
sure.
It's time consuming. The other thing is that programs like Carbon Copy Cloner do have a feature that will do this painstaking comparison, but it slows your backup way down. But it's doing a lot of work. So,
yeah.
Just thought I'd mention that. But, and I don't know if I say Time Machine sucks. I'd say it's lacking.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, I use it. It as I've said, it's just not the thing I rely on solely.
And I would encourage all of our listeners, do not have Time Machine as your only backup, because you will regret it.
Right.
I can almost guarantee it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It would be awful. Yeah. All right. Moving on. He says, and that's what Jan says, moving on to APFS, which is the name for the new Apple file system that Apple has written and is coming out at some point next year. He says, we all have great expectations for it, but I'm holding my many horses for many reasons that I'll explain. Number one, yes, APFS has snapshots, but snapshots aren't backup. It's a representation of the file system at a given point in time that lives on the file system. So if you toast your drive, you toast your snapshots. I didn't hear anything yet about Apple being able to get blocks of snapshot differentials. Number two, even if they were able to copy differential backups using snapshots, it brings a great challenge regarding backup retention, backups browsing. The genius about the way backups work today is that they just have to remove the directory of a backup and magically free up the space used specifically by that backup, thanks to directory hard links. That's how Time Machine works. Being able to browse that directory to use that backup with hard links is easy because it's done at the file system level, not at the block level. Deduplication might be a way to solve the space issue. After all, who needs snapshots if all similar blocks on a file system are pointed to a unique instance on disk? But then again, all I learned so far is Apple is doing this in APFS only when you duplicate a file or folder. They do not maintain a database of blocks to be able to match identical data in line when you bring in new files. The one thing that gives me hope is that APFS is currently incompatible with Time Machine, meaning they are probably working on a special version of Time Machine for APFS. And he says, nothing's ever easy. And that's totally true. I mean, moving to a new file system is a big deal. And Apple says that you can move to this file system without erasing your drive. It will somehow migrate HFS Plus to APFS. And I don't know if that's in the macOS Sierra beta or not. I haven't messed with APFS yet. I haven't really messed with much of the Sierra beta, as I mentioned in the last show. So, what do you think here, John? I mean, I'm with you on that. I have great expectations for APFS. I like the fact that Apple has built a file system that is for the modern age, right? And does some of these things. It's tailored for SSD. I think in true Apple fashion, it's really smart that they have gone deep and made a file system that will work for watch, iPhone, Mac, right? You know, that's really smart, because having it be ubiquitous across their own products will make it make all of those products more robust, which is good. You know, the nuances of it, though, I think I feel like So Apple, you're right that they're not doing any verification of data on anything but the file system. Right. And the reason for that is power consumption and battery life. But I don't know. I mean, you got to make choices somewhere. What do you think?
You know, Dave, I'm a simple man and I have simple needs. And I think we should just go back to MFS.
when were we using MFS? Yeah.
I'm glad you asked that question. So for those that don't know, this was the first file system that Apple came out with, and it was the Macintosh file system.
Right.
And okay. It was simple. Flat. What came after that was then called hierarchical file system. So if I recall correctly, MFS didn't even embrace the concept of directories. All the files were in a single level. No, I'm just joking here. From what I've seen, that their new file system has been inspired by others that do smart things. I think the one, and I think somebody's even come up with a version of this or an open source version called ZFS, and it embraces a lot of the features. So what Apple's doing, like many things, is nothing new, but they're going to add more. You know, as you covered, they're going to be adding more integrity. Now, one could argue that, well, no, I think it's a bad argument. I mean, one could argue that, you know, the preventing data loss and data corruption really isn't the job of the file system. But actually, now that I think about it, but the reason I say that, because we're going to talk about shortly, is one could argue that it's the job of the storage device to take care of that or to assure that in part, depending on who you talk to.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
You know, RAID and all of that, you know, RAID is one way to kind of solve that problem, though you could still have corruption. But RAID offers various levels of duplication and checksums and recovery where, you know, for the most part, if you're on a RAID or RAID like storage device, you can be pretty sure that your data is not going to disappear.
Right. Right. Yep.
But having features within the file system to kind of make sure that. Because I guess the problem is that computer operations, so, you know, software in the operating system, the problem is that bad things are always going to happen. And this is just the nature of any sort of computer storage medium, whether it be RAM and stuff like that. And I've read a few things on this, and it actually does get kind of scary. So a lot of times, you know, software is going to be writing data either to a drive or to memory and reading it back.
Yeah.
Sometimes it gets it wrong. Because it's just the nature of either magnetic or memory devices. They'll get it wrong.
Yeah. So
you may say write a one and it'll write a zero instead, or you say write, you know, five and it'll write six. Oops. You know, that's just,
yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, there are ways to you know, and it's funny though, because, you know, one thing I observe is that Mac does not use, for the most part, as far as I know, most Macs do not use what's called ECC or error correction codes in memory.
In RAM. That's right. Yeah.
In RAM. Yeah. This is one way to prevent bad things from happening is to use memory chips that kind of have a level of redundancy. I think the price you pay is that it's probably not as potentially not as fast as memory without this feature.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. So there's an interesting thing. Michael Tsai, who was first well known for making SpamSiv and now makes Eagle Filer. I guess he might still make SpamSiv. He has been doing a great job actually collecting a bunch of links and commentary about APFS that we will put in the show notes for sure. But about this data integrity, he actually quotes the DTrace blog, which is Adam Leventhal, I believe. Yeah, Adam Leventhal's blog. And Adam, I don't know his entire history. It's hard to say. It's hard for me to say, but I think he either was one of the creators of ZFS or worked on it pretty deeply when it was being created at Sun, I believe is where ZFS came from. But so he's got, you know, he's definitely there. And Adam was at WWDC and in the session when they talked about APFS, and then he cornered some of the engineers and talked to them about it and got some more details because they're, you know, happy to talk about this stuff. And what he says, and this is the section that Michael Tsai quoted, he says, APFS removes the most common way of a user achieving local data redundancy, copying files. A copied file in APFS actually creates a lightweight clone with no duplicated data. Corruption of the underlying device would mean that both copies, because it's really one set of data, were damaged, whereas with full copies, localized data corruption would just affect one of them. And then he says APFS checksums its own metadata, right? We talked about checksums, CRCs, but not user data. The justification for checksumming metadata is strong. There's relatively not much of it, so the checksums don't consume much storage, and losing metadata can cast a potentially huge shadow of data loss. If, for example, metadata for a top-level directory is corrupted, then potentially all the data on the disk could be rendered inaccessible. ZFS duplicates metadata and triple duplicates top-level metadata for exactly this reason. So that part makes sense. Like your file system, the directories, and all of that are protected against data loss. That's good.
Well, you know, I like the concept that a copy is not occurring. Because as I mentioned, that typically involves reading it into RAM,
yeah,
and then writing it out again. And the potential is that what gets put in RAM and taken out of RAM could get corrupted. And I imagine that's what happens these days with a lot of file systems. It writes it and it doesn't make sure that what was written is what was read.
But here's the thing. The problem with that is if you haven't read that file in a long time, it may have already begun to suffer from something called bit rot, which is the concept of that your physical storage medium has failed you in some way that you are not yet aware of. And this happens, especially with long-term storage, but this definitely happens. So if you've got bit rot, either before or after you make that quote-unquote copy, which isn't really a copy, you have no protection, right? And you wouldn't even know that there was bit rot until you tried to access the actual file. And this is where Adam goes further. He says, explicitly not checksumming user data is a little more interesting. Apple engineers I spoke with claimed that bit rot was not a problem for users of Apple devices. But if your software can't detect errors, then you have no idea how your devices really perform in the field. ZFS has found data corruption on multi-million dollar storage arrays. I wouldn't be surprised if it didn't find errors, or better to say, I would be surprised, is what he says, rather. I would be surprised if it didn't find errors coming from TLC, the cheapest NAND chips in some of Apple's devices. And Michael Tsai backs this up. He says Eagle Filer has detected a lot of bit rot for him over the years, including on SSDs that come from Apple's factories. So Apple's saying our stuff is so good that we don't suffer bit rot. I mean, that's just like, that's crazy talk. There's no such thing as, you know, perfect storage. Apple's engineers also said, and this wasn't quoted here in this part of it, but I think it's elsewhere in this Michael Tsai piece, is that battery life was also a concern, right? Because the more data protection that you're doing, the more CPU you're using, the more of the drive that you're using. And so the more battery life you are consuming. And, obviously with all of Apple's devices, you know, including Macs, because so many of the Macs they sell are portable, that this is, you know, a problem. They say, well, if you use third-party drives, you might have an issue, but our drives are so good that you'll never have bit rot, or we've never seen bit rot. It's like, dude, there's a little bit too much Kool-Aid there. But basically what it means is you have to do backups still. But there's, you know, this magic answer. And maybe that's a good thing. You know, maybe the fact that we're even talking about this is going to help dispel any myths about APFS mitigating the need for real backups. And it won't. No file system will. I don't think. Not even your NAS. Because you can have bit rot on a NAS, too. Just because there's multiple drives doesn't mean... doesn't your Synology warn you every month? Hey, dude, you haven't done data scrubbing yet this month. It should.
No.
Well...
It gives me a report every month on the health of my drives.
No, but if you log into DSM, it with version 6, it has now started warning users every month, you need to do data scrubbing. Well,
I'm not receiving that warning.
Whether or not you're getting that warning, you need to do data scrubbing. I don't do it every month. I do it every 3 months. And you go sort of jumping to the Synology geek gab portion of this. If you go into Disk Station Manager and go into Storage Manager and go into Volume and choose your volume if you have more than one and click Manage, you have the very first option is Start Data Scrubbing. And what that does is it goes through and reads every bit of data you have stored on the drive and makes sure that it is readable. Because, you know, especially with a NAS, long-term storage, you're probably not looking at every bit of data on a regular basis on there.
So what are you saying? Storage Manager.
Storage Manager. Yeah.
I'll follow along with you. Okay.
Yeah, of course.
I get Overview, Volume. Okay.
Yep.
On Volume?
Click on Volume and then click on Manage.
My Manage button is grayed out.
Have you selected the volume?
Yes.
What does your volume status say?
Normal. Synology Hybrid RAID. Maybe it's because I'm running only two drives.
Maybe. Yeah, it might explain it.
Yeah. No, manage is grayed out.
Isn't that
again
weird?
Because.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, because my configuration, so Dave's is a little, so the one that they set me up with is their DS713 Plus, I believe, which has two drive bays. I can get expansion.
Sure.
And I'll have to chat with them about that. But right now I have two 2.73 terabyte drives, and they're set up in what's known as Synology Hybrid RAID, which basically means that one drive is a copy of the other. So it's a very simple RAID implementation.
Wait, we should rewind, though, because, and now we're in the Synology geek gab portion of this, which is totally fine. No, this is great. I just want to drop a timestamp because otherwise I'm going to lose where we are. The Synology Hybrid RAID is actually the same thing I'm running here. Two drives, it the only thing it can do. So Synology Hybrid RAID probably for yours says with one disk fault tolerance protection.
Correct.
And you can, and so does mine. I could, because I have multiple, more than three drives or whatever, I could have set it up as two disk fault protection if I wanted, but I did not. So on mine or on yours, if you added a third drive, it would use only one disk as its parity drive, essentially, for fault protection. So you are as a byproduct of the fact that you only have two drives, one of them is used for fault protection. It's effectively a mirror of the first, right? I mean, because there's no other way to do that. But if you had a third drive in there, you would get all of the storage of the third drive added to your storage, right? You have two 3 terabyte drives, essentially. They show up as 273. So 2 3-terabyte drives, and you get essentially 3 terabytes worth of storage. If you added another 3-terabyte drive, you would now have 6 terabytes of storage, because just one of the drives is being used for the fault tolerance. And that's Synology Hybrid RAID. The reason they call it Hybrid RAID is you can have drives of different sizes in your RAID setup, and it will, for the most part, maximize the storage space, which, whereas with traditional RAID, you can only use drives of the same size, or at least if you added a 5-terabyte drive or a series of them and your RAID array was set at 3s, it would treat those 5s as though they were all 3s, whereas Synology Hybrid RAID starts to get smart about it as you add more. So I just didn't want people to be confused by that. And it's smart that you set yours up as Synology Hybrid RAID, because if you had set it up as mirrored, it would have made no difference to you at the beginning. But like you said, if you're going to add an expansion bay with some drives, that's where SHR lets you really go nuts.
Right. And I think the question we got here from our chat room, which you can always reach at macgeekab.com/stream.
That's correct.
Pretty sure that's where it's at. Where you can hear us and you can interact with us, which is oh so much fun. More fun than Barrel of Monkeys.
Did you just call all our folks in the chat room a barrel of monkeys?
Well, I'd love monkeys. Monkeys are awesome, man.
Haven't you always wanted a monkey?
I want one of those little cool ones. I forgot.
Capuchin?
I think that's it. Yeah, the ones that are in a lot of the movies. I mean, they're just super cool monkeys. Yeah. But But no, one of the questions we got from Furby's as to my setup is, I believe he's correct in saying that my setup is essentially a RAID 0 setup.
The effective result of it is that it's RAID 0, but it is not RAID 0. That's right.
Yeah, it's theirs, but
right.
Right, because as you pointed out, their RAID can handle different size drives. RAID 0, of course, being mirroring, I think, which is one drive is a copy of another, so you have some redundancy.
Yeah.
And then, as you mentioned, I think when you start to get to RAID level 5, that's where it introduces what you call parity, which is basically a very simple form of error correction, I think.
Well, it's more like than error. Yeah, it's error checks, correction.
I believe it's a collection of checksums.
It's reversible checksums. So if, like, I have, I think, 6 drives in my Synology now. I should look because I got it open here. But if I lose any one of them, it will rebuild the lost data immediately, effectively, from what's left on the other drives. So every drive has the ability to be removed without losing your data, ostensibly. But again, without doing data scrubbing on a regular basis, I don't know that, unless I pull a drive out and test, you know, throw caution to the wind. But that's the point. So, yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting. It's interesting. So if you have any other questions or thoughts about APFS, send those in.
We'll
transition to the Synology thing in a minute.
Sorry, but I think what was said was incorrect. So RAID 0 is striping.
Oh, no, you're RAID 1, which is mirroring.
Right. Okay, and you can look this up. We'll link to it, or you can find it easily enough here. But RAID 0 is the simplest form, and it offers no data protection or anything. But so it's called striping, and it basically spreads. So it makes a number of drives look like a single drive. So that's RAID 0. And why would you want to do that? Well, you could use it for performance or also
totally performance. Yeah.
Just because you can be writing to multiple drives, and you can make multiple drives appear as a single drive. But yeah, part of the benefit is that if you have the right controller, it can be writing data to multiple drives at the same time, so you get a throughput
and reading data from multiple drives at the same time. That's the where a lot of the speed benefits come in with RAID arrays. Even with Synology Hybrid RAID. I mean, no one disk in there would be fast enough to fill up my gigabit Ethernet connection. Mm-hmm. But with all of them running, I can read or write data at and completely soak up my gigabit connection, which is awesome.
Yeah, and then RAID 1 is essentially what I have. So no, mine is essentially RAID 1, which is the same data is on 2 different drives.
That's right.
And one is a copy of the other. So so if one drive totally fails, I can still access the data.
Right. That's right. Yeah, that's right.
I think then you got 2 and 3 and 4, which from what I see is something that not a lot of people use. And then, yeah, then the next RAID level is RAID 5 that a lot of people use. And that's where it contains information that helps you recreate data that gets damaged.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
And there's more and you can read up on it. But I think those are the most popular for most purposes is RAID 0, RAID 1 and RAID 5.
Yep. Yeah. All right. I want to take a quick detour here, John, and I want to talk about Gazelle, our first sponsor, and then I want to get back to and then we'll talk about Synology in depth here. So Gazelle at gazelle.com, longtime listener to this show will know that Gazelle is the place where you can turn your iPhones, your old iPhones, into cash. If you're like me and you upgrade your iPhone every year, you get a new iPad pretty regularly, whatever that is, you start to wind up with a pile of these things because you don't want to get rid of the old one right away. You want to keep it around just in case there's a problem with the new one or whatever. So you make a backup, you start using the new one, and then suddenly like 3 months have gone by and you're like, oh crap, I got to use that phone for something. So maybe you hand it down to a family member, but then that person has an extra phone, right? At some point in the chain there's an extra phone left over. And sometimes that phone sits and collects dust for a while. Well, instead of the phone collecting dust, you can collect cash. And that's what Gazelle does. You visit gazelle.com, you tell them what you have, and they will tell you what the price is that they will pay you for it. If you like that, they will immediately send you a box at their expense. You pack the thing into the box, you ship it back to them at their expense with their shipping label and tape. So you don't have to do anything. It's all right in the box. They get the device. They confirm that it works or doesn't. If you told them it wasn't working, they'll give you a price on that too. And then they send you your money. That's how it works. It's an awesome service. I've used it countless times and it works great. Sometimes they get stuff that's in such good shape that they're willing to sell that directly back to different customers. Now they clean it up first and get all your data off of it, although you should get your data off of it before you send it to them. And they walk you through that process too. But if you're looking for a used iOS device or another piece of handheld electronics like that, visit Gazelle. And instead of clicking sell, click buy on their homepage there. And you can go through and get this stuff that's guaranteed by Gazelle and cleaned up by them. And it's really nice stuff. So you got to check this out. Go to gazelle.com. And when you're checking out, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Tell them Matt Geekab. That's who sent you. That helps them. That helps us. That helps you. Thanks so much to Gazelle for sponsoring this episode. All right, John. So we dipped our toe in the water of Synology. Many folks have been asking. And where I figured we would start or resume, as the case may be, is with the... with just what we do with it. So there's a lot of things that I run on my Synology. Some of those include, like a destination for my backups, some files that I'm just going to store there, that sort of thing.
Right. Nothing... Well, let's back up a moment.
Okay.
Could we? No, yeah. I just want to, for those that don't know
sure.
what Synology is, though most would, but I just want to make sure I got my facts straight here.
Okay.
So what I have is a Synology unit that connects to a network, otherwise known as a NAS, network attached storage. Now, I believe Synology makes those, but I also believe they make direct connect versions. I'm almost certain they do, which use a different interface.
I've never heard of anything from them that's a direct connect.
No,
I don't think so.
No, like Thunderbolt or no, I guess the other guys do. Okay, I just want to make sure of that. Okay,
yeah, it's
so
it's,
they're all
it's
so
network.
They're all network. So everything that Synology makes currently is all network attached.
Okay. That's well, yeah. I mean, they make their router, which is a sort of a separate device. I mean, it functions as a different purpose, but. Runs a very similar operating system. But yeah, Synology's disk stations, which is what we're really talking about here, are their network attached storage devices. And the cool part about having, as I said, you have a network attached storage device. Great. That means that you can store some of your files. You can point your time machine back up at it. Nothing wrong with that. But what it really means is that on your network, you have this device with gobs and gobs of storage and a computer inside of it. By definition, if it's going to be on the network and acting as its own citizen on the network, if you will, it has to have a CPU. So then you can stop and think about, well, hey, if there's a device with all that storage and a CPU, couldn't it do things for me? Because it needs to be on all the time, right? That's how it's going to work. But it's a relatively low power CPU. It's not going to chew up tons of juice because there's no screen attached to it, nothing like that. So better than leaving a computer on all the time, you can leave your NAS on all the time and it can do a lot of fun things for you. And the Synology folks are really focused on the Apple market. Not only do they make their disk station and then the apps that go on the disk station, but they also make apps for iOS. So that you have this sort of, perfect match of what you're traveling with and what you've got back at home or at the office. So now that you've got a device that has some stuff on it, well, what kind of stuff would you store on there? You'd probably store your movies on there, right? You'd probably store your music files, big things. You'd probably store your photos. Well, great. Now you've got a device with your photos, your music, and your movies. connected to your network with a CPU. Hey, now you can do some fun things. And sure enough, that's what Synology has built into their devices. They have three of their own packages called Audio Station, Video Station, and Photo Station that do exactly what you might think they do. So Video Station is awesome, right? Because it's looks at all of the movies you have now put on the device. You tell it what movies to look at. So if there's things that you have on there that you don't want Video Station looking at, that's fine. It looks at them. It builds metadata for your movie. So even if you don't have like all the movie posters or any of that stuff, it figures it out because it links with all these different online databases to sort that out. And then you can play movies right from your web browser. You can run the DS video app on your iPhone or iPad to not only play movies, but copy them to your device for when you travel, like on an airplane, offline viewing. And they've also got an Apple TV app now for DS video that lets you do the same thing. So now you've got one media library that streams wherever you want it. Same is true for Audio Station. Photo Station actually goes even beyond that, backing up your iPhone photos automatically when you're home to your disk station. And then you can view your photo libraries from anywhere. It's very cool stuff. I don't know which ones of those you're using, John, but with those three, I'm running my own private cloud.
I'm going to tell you what I'm using, Dave.
Yeah.
But I want to add a little something first.
Of course. Of course.
To talk about the hardware. All right. So you are correct. The thing is that there are other NAS vendors that also make Direct Connect. But yeah. So what I've seen, Synology at this point, as far as their disk devices, are just network. Now, one of the cool things that I like about the network devices, Dave, is that a lot of them, so you could have just one network connection, typically gigabit Ethernet for most modern computers. That's what you would be using. Here's the one thing that once I bought a more sophisticated switch, I'm able to do with the disk station, and this just made my inner geek so happy. There is something that you can do with a network, and the Synology supports this, where you can basically bond two connections together and make them look as one. Why would you want to do that? Well, number one, because you can. But number two,
of course.
So I have two. So the Synology that I have has an option where I can take the 2 gigabit Ethernet ports on this, and because my switch supports it, I can tell the Synology, hey, by the way, can you mash these two together and make them appear to be a single 2 gigabit pipe? And it's like, sure. So that's one thing on the hardware side, that they're higher. Well, this is a relatively low-end unit, and even this supports it. So, their big boy units do as well, where you can bond multiple. I think they have units with 4 and probably 8 Ethernet connections.
I've got 4 network ports on mine, yeah.
Okay, so you, in theory, could get a 4 gigabit pipe. Of course, I don't know if you're all the drives you have in there would support that throughput, but that's one neat thing on the hardware side.
I don't know that I can. I don't know that I can bond more than 2 of them together.
It depends on your switch. Your switch has to support protocols, right. And there's different protocols. So you may be able to just do 2, or you may be able to do 4. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it's also called link aggregation.
It's link aggregation. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So out of the things that you mentioned, I would say that the one that I use the most, I dabbled with Photo Station.
Okay.
And some people have
talked about it recently. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really actively use it. I think Audio Station I did use for a while, but right now my primary device for streaming music is the Heos, Denon Heos. Use that. No, I'm sorry. I'm lying. I do use Audio Station, but what Audio Station does for me is I'm almost certain that Audio Station makes my Synology look like a DLNA source.
That's right. Yeah.
Which the Denon Heos speaker system can see DLNA audio sources. So yes, so I'm constantly using Audio Station because it provides a DLNA. DLNA is, I forget. But DLNA is a standard for publishing media. And right. If you have a device that can understand it. So yeah, so I use Audio Station all the time.
Yeah.
To stream my music. Video Station, primarily what I do is a lot of times I will rip a movie using Handbrake and then store it in the video folder. And then, yeah, as you said, it's awesome. So I think it uses IMDb or some.
It uses several different online databases to figure out what movies you've got and then pull the data.
Yeah.
It usually gets it right.
Yeah. It sometimes gets it wrong.
Well, if you name your files right, so those of you that are using Synology, there is a naming convention, and Plex is another app that basically combines the functionality of all three of these things we're talking about, audio, video, and photos, into one thing. And you can run Plex on your disk station too. In fact, you can run it on exactly the same libraries that the video station and audio station see. And it works great. I run them in parallel, and sometimes I use Plex and sometimes I use Video Station. But there is a naming convention that, if you use it, makes identifying your movies much simpler. And basically what it is name of the movie dot year that the movie was released dot file type. So, you know, I don't know, Zootopia.2016.mp4, right? I think that was 2016. I don't know. I don't have that movie. But that would be one way of, you know, that's how, if you name your files that, it really gives the right hints to the various parsers to get it right. Yeah.
Yeah. I found that too. The naming.
Now here's the thing we haven't talked about. We've both talked about how we use these things, and we talked about how we use at home. Right. We'll come back around. That's fine. We talked about how we use them at home. And I talked about how I sync it for offline viewing, but because it's a network device, if you have an always on network connection, which most of us do with cable modems and DSL and that sort of thing, you can access all of these things remotely. So I use Audio Station. Actually, before I got Apple Music with the iCloud Music Library, I was using Audio Station constantly from my car because my phone could just magic. It made no difference whether I was at home behind my router or out and about on the other side of my router. Audio Station would stream from my disk station regardless. I mean, one would be doing it over, you know, my data connection on my cell phone, but it's not that much data, and it's really no different than, you know, streaming anything on any other music service. So with Apple Music, obviously I'm using that a little bit less, but if you want to create your own, you know, quote unquote iCloud music library, but personal cloud music library, then it's just automatic with the stuff. It's really, and it works really well. I've done it with Video Station where, you know, the night before a plane ride home, I'm like, oh, I want a different movie for the plane. And I just launch, you know, DS Video, and I go, it may, you know, it's just like I'm home. I scroll through. Okay. That one, hit download. And, you know, and then I plug my iPad in on charge and I go to sleep. And by the time I wake up in the morning, as long as the hotel's Wi-Fi is fast enough, boom, I've got a movie. Good to go. It's pretty awesome.
Now, and the reason you can do that, or maybe you can do it without this, but another feature that they offer that's really neat is they support what's known as DDNS. What the heck is that, you ask? And I'll tell you what it is. Dynamic Domain Name Service. Every device on the internet has an IP address. Though a lot of times there's this thing called DHCP, which introduces the potential for you to get a different public-facing IP address for your device. A lot of times it won't change, and it may not change for years. I've had this happen. But especially if you like cycle power on your router or something like that, it may grab a different IP address. Well, that's kind of inconvenient. Say you're out and about and you want to access your network remotely. Well, if you don't know the IP address, you're kind of in trouble. But they have something called DDNS, which is a service that will constantly check your IP address, but it'll also bond it to a name. So, for example, Synology offers this service, and you get an address that is something.synology.me, I think it is. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's something like that. Yeah, really, you do. You get an address like that, but you also just get a Synology name for your device, and that's all I use.
Okay. Those kind of overlap.
They do overlap. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Because sometimes for some Synology apps, I'll enter that name as the IP address of it sounds like I don't need to. I could do it other ways.
You can do it other ways. Yeah. It's very robust. You know, these things have been around. Synology's been making these things for a long time, and they really have solved a lot of the difficult issues that just come along with this. And you know, DDNS is one of those things. It's super handy. And it's, again, it's just all baked right in. And speaking of baked right in, you manage this thing from a web browser, and the web interface is awesome. I mean, it feels like a computer desktop. You get menus, and you can have multiple windows open simultaneously. In fact, you can drive yourself a little bit crazy with that if you want. But it's really, it manages itself really, really well. There's just all kinds of stuff you can do. I am trying to think of the other things that I use as I look through here. I mentioned Plex.
I'll toss one out.
Go ahead. Yeah.
VPN server. We've talked about VPNs. VPNs is, if you're out and about and you want to secure your network connection or you want to access your network from afar, you probably want to be running a VPN or virtual private network. Well, they have a VPN server. And yeah. Synology's actually lets you set up one of the three, I think the only three, maybe there are others, but it lets you set up either a PPTP, an OpenVPN, or an L2TP/IPsec VPN. I personally run OpenVPN, though I know you have a different preference, Dave. And then on my iOS device, I actually run, so the program I run is called, I think it's called OpenVPN.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about this because, finish your thought. And then I want to talk about VPNs sort of as a separate thing, but
okay,
go ahead. Yeah. Finish your thought.
So the
thing
about is, VPN, yeah. All right. So on iOS, I use a client that's called OpenVPN. And when I run that, it lets me connect to, it creates a secure connection to my Synology, for my iOS device. The program that I use on my Mac, I think it's called TunnelBlick, and that's a OpenVPN client that you can run on your Mac. So if I'm out and about, depending on the device that I'm using, I can get into my network and create a secure connection, which is a good thing.
So this is interesting, and this is going to be very important to all of us that are going to be running iOS 10 and macOS Sierra come this fall. Apple is a company that's obsessed about security. For a long time, I have not used the VPN server on my Synology because my router supports VPNing and has for a long time. It was one of the things that attracted me to the DDWirt router, you know, third party firmware years ago. It was the only way I could get a router, you know, at like home user prices that would let me do a VPN. But at the moment, DDWirt supports only one type of, actually, it supports two types of VPNs. It supports PPTP and OpenVPN. OpenVPN works, but the problem is configuring it sucks. Not only is
it... Oh, don't be such a baby.
No. Here's the big thing. It is not native to iOS or OS 10, right? Okay. So you need third-party software to make it work. And even with third-party software, you need to exchange a certificate between your server, in this case your disk station, and every single device you want to connect. So if you're out and about, let's say you're traveling, you wipe your iPhone because you had a problem, now you want to connect to your VPN, you can't unless you have that certificate stored somewhere that you can then re-import it to your iPhone. So it's all doable. It's just there's some pain points, like anything where we talk about, you know, living on the continuum of convenience versus security. OpenVPN leans a little more on the security side. I was always okay with PPTP. It uses an encryption method that is awful and very hackable, but requires no certificates to be exchanged. So it was like, awesome, I'll just use that. It's native to OS 10 and iOS. Great. I'll use that. It's built into my router. I don't even need to worry about two pieces of hardware working. As long as my router is working, I can VPN. Great. And then I installed the macOS Sierra beta while I was out at WWDC and immediately realized that my VPN profile to my home machine was gone. And I thought, well, this is weird. Let me go add it. No, it says, sure, you can add any one of these types of VPNs, and PPTP is not on the list. And recently in both OS 10 and iOS version, you know, El Capitan and iOS 9, it started warning me that PPTP is not all that secure and maybe I should use something else and I would just skip those warnings. Well, it turns out those warnings were a bit of a heads up that, hey, we're deprecating this. PPTP is no longer, it no longer exists in the OSs that we will get in the fall. So I had to start using something else. My, like I said, my router supports OpenVPN, but I didn't want to jump through those hoops. And especially on my router, configuring it there is like an entirely manual process just to get the server up and running. And then, you know, I got to go further and get the clients. So I thought, well, my VPN server on my Synology is right here. That'll let me connect L2TP and IPsec. OS 10 or Mac OS Sierra supports it. iOS 10 will support it. And of course, iOS 9 does. So it lets me use it today. And I configured it and I configured all the port forwarding that was necessary. And I looked and yep, okay, all good. Doesn't work. Won't let me connect. Won't let me connect. Won't let me connect. Tried and tried. Oh, hey, look, it let me connect. Oh, now it won't let me connect anymore. It was very unreliable or unpredictable. And so I did some digging because, you know, it's what I do, John. It's what we do. Turns out Back to My Mac also uses something very similar with IPsec. And Back to My Mac will commandeer any port forwarding that I had already done on my router. So instead of routing these IPsec packets to my disk station, it was routing them to any number of my Macs behind, you know, in my on my network. Once I turned off Back to My Mac on every single device that exists in my network, then L2TP and IPsec worked great. So if you are using a PPTP VPN, that's a lot of letters, you need to think about that before you start putting iOS 10 and all of that stuff on there. Because, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah.
So the only challenge, so like you said, I like OpenVPN because it essentially provides you with a token. The token being a certificate. And if you don't have it, correct, you're not getting into the network. Whereas your implementation, if I beat you over the head as you're trying to log in and I know your password, then yay, I'm into your network. I win.
Well, but with L2TP, you need two pieces of information.
Oh, you do?
You do. You need a system-wide token, which is similar to the certificate, but it can be much shorter. So I know that token and I can give that to my family, right? And it's the same for everyone. And then each user has their own username and password. So it's essentially like there's three pieces of information you need, but it,
so is the token,
it's a key, it's a word, it's a password.
Okay.
It's a separate password. Yeah.
All right. So there's like a system password and then each individual has a password. Okay.
Bingo.
Got it.
Yep. I think I could set it up with tokens, but I haven't. So, No, I'm trying to look here. No, they call it a pre-shared key is what that is.
Oh, all right. Yep. All right. Now the only thing I had to do, which got kind of tricky, so the I have the TP-Link wireless the router Archer C9. I love the thing to death. It's great for 802.11ac. My only fish shake is I think it's sometimes, because I do believe that a lot of their staff is overseas, some of their wording is kind of weird. And so I actually had to dig a bit to find out, because the thing is that I had to tell this device how to allow someone coming outside my network to get to the Synology. And they put it in a weird place, Dave. So I actually had to go to NAT forwarding, advanced virtual servers, and actually define a map from the outside on UDP port 1194 to the IP address, the internal IP address of my device.
Now your disk station, and this is one little anomaly with the way the disk station works. If when you set up your VPN service for the first time, or when your disk station reboots, it will attempt to auto program your router with either UPnP or NAT PMP, which are just protocols that essentially let devices configure their own port forwarding. The problem is it doesn't ever check to confirm that those are still in existence. So if you reboot your router and it the process of rebooting your router happens to lose those settings, your disk station will just assume, well, I set it once, it should be fine. You know, it doesn't do a daily reprogramming of that, which frankly, I think it should. But that was probably your problem. It, you know, you probably had rebooted your router and it just didn't work. You know what I mean? So,
Yeah, what I'm trying to figure now is they also have a UPnP section, and it seems that somebody, I'm trying to figure this out, has set up port 30416. Hmm.
That's probably Skype.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that pointing to your, what address does it point to? Does it point to your Mac? I mean, we're on a Skype call right now.
It's on 1.87. Let me look because I don't. Yep. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, wasn't that nice? Okay. So Skype talked to this and said, hey, create these two tunnels.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Very nice.
That way we can have a direct connection, even though you've got a router in between. And so do I, you know, but it just done. Yeah. Yeah. So it's cool. I use something on my Synology called CrashPlan. We've talked about that before. It's a Java-based backup client. And actually, it works as a client and server. So you need to install Java on your Synology. This is one of these third-party packages that you kind of have to jump through a few hoops. It's not terrible. But being able to have CrashPlan on it means that I can back up my entire disk station if I want to CrashPlan servers, which is handy. It also means that my disk station can be a backup destination for me or anybody I want to give access to. So, for example, I could have you backing up to my disk station. I have my mom backing up to it. And it's, you know, I don't have to think about it. It's just good to go. Cross-platform, happy, happy. So it's cool. It's a little bit of work to set up. But for what you get, it was worth it. And it's free. You can pay for a CrashPlan subscription, but if you just want to use it as your own CrashPlan destination and not host with them, then it's 100% free, which is cool. And that's, you know, again, these are the kind of things that that the disk station, you know, or any kind of NAS lets you do. I run, you know, we use an IRC channel, and I'm going to say, I think it might make sense. Alex is going to cheer here to move to a Slack channel for our chat that goes along with the live stream, because we'll have more history and things like that. So we are going, when I get back from Europe, we're going to work that out and at least test it. But for now, because we don't have a Slack channel and we use this IRC thing, which is an old, I mean, it's been around forever. You probably know what it is. There's no history with IRC. If I log out and 10 people start having a conversation, I won't see any of that. And when I log back in, I'll see what happens after I'm logged in. Well, I use this thing called ZNC, which runs on my disk station and keeps me connected to our IRC server all the time. And then when I want to connect, I actually connect to my IRC client to my disk station, and it shows me everything that has happened since I last connected to the disk station, which is really cool. And I can do it either locally here or from wherever I want, which is pretty cool. So it's cool. It's fun. I like it. It's a blast having this device on the network that not only provides a real service, you know, my family has been going nuts all week, downloading movies to their iPads and all of that for our plane rides and that sort of thing. But it really provides a handy service. I use it as a time machine destination. Actually, mine has a couple of USB ports on it, and a couple of them are USB 3. So I have a Direct Connect Drobo attached to one of the USB ports on my disk station. And not only is that a backup destination for the disk station itself, it's exposed to my network as a backup destination for Time Machine. It's super handy. Here we are. I've had a disk station for 5 years. Every year I probably add two things to what I do here. And I'm always like, man, I should have done this a long time ago. This is so cool. But, you know, I can dig in a little bit and have some fun with it and then kind of leave it alone. I have Transmission running on there, which is a BitTorrent client that if I want to download any torrents or anything, again, I don't have to do it on my computer. I just throw the torrent file in a folder there, and it auto like starts the download, and I'm good to go. Don't have to think about it. When it finishes, it tells me. It's got NoteStation is pretty cool. It's your own Evernote type server. And if Evernote gets really wonky on us, John, we might wind up moving to NoteStation. So,
Oh.
Because then we could have our disk station sync with each other. I mean, you could, you wouldn't even need a disk station to connect to my note station, for example. But if you've got two of them, they can talk to each other. And it'll actually pull in all. I use note station to import all my Evernote data, and it saves it here, which is kind of cool. It's a manual process. It's not like doing it every day. In fact, I'll think about it. Right now, I'll start it right now because I'm, you know, I'm crazy like that.
Yeah, and actually USB device support, so I found mixed feelings about it. So I think at one point I did try to plug in a USB drive and copy a file over.
Yeah.
And it was kind of wonky. It wasn't...
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if it was something with this unit not having enough juice or what, but it was. It didn't always complete the copy. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe it was a bug in the version of DSM I was running or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing that it could potentially do, though I didn't, again, I wasn't quite on the mark, is you can actually use it as a print server.
Oh, totally.
What I did is, the thing is I plugged my HP inkjet, but it's kind of a wacky model, and the thing is the driver that it loaded wasn't quite right, so it wasn't quite the best solution for me. But for a lot of printers, USB printers, you can plug them into the disk station, and then they will appear as a, I think it'll publish it using Bonjour or, you know, zero configuration. It'll advertise the printer to your network and you connect to it.
Yeah.
But because, it didn't load quite the right driver because my inkjet is a 13 by 19 and it didn't quite grok that. And then I printed stuff and it wasn't placed properly.
Sure.
So I plugged it back into my Mac and used my Mac Mini as a print server. And that works fine. It loads the, driver. But that's neat too, that you can also plug in a lot of USB devices and it'll do clever things with them as well.
Yeah.
I don't think, now if I plugged in a USB SSD, could I make it part of, I suspect I can't make it part of the array, that has to be.
No, I have a DS1815 Plus, right? So it's last year's model. I don't think they've got an 8-bay unit for 2016 yet, but so it's a beefy thing. And because I've got some extra bays, I took an old SSD that I had and put that in and as an SSD cache just to speed up, you know, kind of local operations. A little bit decadent for sure, you know, just because that's, you know, it's a little bit nuts to do that, but it actually works great. It made a lot of things like the UI and that sort of stuff. It seemed like it made it faster. I don't know, you know, it could just be the placebo effect, but it certainly, that's what it seemed like to me. I'm always regularly impressed by the disk station. I'm actually having a problem right now with video station. They added transcoding to it. So for offline viewing, so I can tell it, hey, I want that movie on my iPad, but I don't need the big honking, you know, 15 gig Blu-ray version of it. I just need you to crunch it down to something that's going to look good on my iPad. And the disk station will do that transcoding. If you have a disk station that CPU that can do it, which mine does. And then when it finishes transcoding, it will transfer it to your iPad currently. And I don't know what's going on and why this is happening. Synology is actually doing some remote diagnostics. It finishes transcoding and then it sits there and it says, okay, I'm done transcoding. It's like, now I'd like that on my iPad, please. And it's like, oh, sure you would. But it never actually starts that process, or it takes days for that process to actually trigger. So we used Plex for this trip to copy everything to our iOS devices, and that worked just fine, doing the same kind of transcoding thing. So it's fun. I like this. It's like I said, it's been a fun thing. Listeners to the show, certainly, this isn't the first time you've heard us talk about Synology. So I want to talk about Powerline, though, John. Can we jump quick and do Andy's thing before we say sayonara here?
Yeah,
are we done with Synology or no? This was fun spending a half hour on a topic. You know, it's not something we usually do, and it was kind of fun letting go of the reins.
I think the one thing I noticed, I'll maybe close with this here, but sure. One thing that I thought that was kind of cool that they added, which so they have a whole bunch of packages here, but they added something that I think is new to DSM-6, or maybe I just never saw it before. But if you go to their control panel, I think they actually have like a security audit tool. Yeah, and I actually remember running it.
Oh, yeah.
I'll have to double check where it is, but it actually will look at the configuration of your Synology and tell you certain things that you're doing that aren't very good ideas. Like, I think in my case, it was like, yeah, your SSH is on the standard port. You may want to move it to another one. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Oh, that is.
And
well,
I think it said you may want to have password rules enforced so that you.
Yep.
You don't create a password that sucks. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Yep.
So it kind of examines its. I mean, it'd be nice if it happened in real time, but I had not run that tool before, and I think I actually got a notification. It came up and it said, "Hey, you know, you should you should run the security audit tool because it's a good thing to do."
Yeah.
And, so kind of self-healing. I thought that was neat.
Yeah, self-aware.
The other thing here, I mean, to give you an example of the extent of the stuff that they offer here. So I'm looking, if I look in the package manager security, I can install antivirus by McAfee, antivirus essential from Synology, which I guess is their package. Mm-hmm. So you can actually scan your file. So I would assume what happens is that it'll actually scan your files.
Yeah, I'm running them. I have it scanned for viruses. Once a week. Yeah, for viruses. Yeah.
I mean, especially if you're a repository for documents, you want to make sure that you don't spread viruses. So that's
pretty cool.
Pretty neat feature. So yeah, it's crazy. I would say the only thing is the only complaint that I'll have is sometimes getting tasks done is not always easy because they put the touch points in like two or three different places.
Yeah,
so if you're setting up Time Machine, the thing is you have to go to one place to define the size of the volume, and then you have to go to another place to
set the user account or whatever. Yeah,
though they get better with each release, and
they
right
do.
Now I think they're up to DSM 6, which they fixed a lot of things that made me unhappy before. Yeah. So thanks, Synology.
That's fun. Yeah, I agree. Hey, so Brian Monroe says that notes in iOS 10 and presumably macOS Sierra, people have been doing some digging and found that indeed the notes app, which just uses iCloud and is built into our Apple devices, will allow collaboration, which means not only can I create notebooks that are shared amongst all my devices, but I could create a notebook with you, John, that you and I share, even though we don't share an iCloud account. And which is essentially what we do with Evernote or what we just talked about doing with NoteStation. So if Apple actually gets that right, then we don't need to worry about any of this. We just need to increase our iCloud storage. So that's cool. Yeah.
Mine's already increased.
Same.
I'm throwing down the big
99 cents a month. Yeah.
Well, it rounds up to a dollar with tax. But,
I have no tax here, man.
Really?
Yeah, I live in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I wonder why they apply sales to...
Because you live in a state. So here's the deal. Here's the way sales tax works.
Wait, you don't have sales tax?
Not in New Hampshire, no.
Oh, interesting. That's right. Okay, we have, I think it's 6.25% right now.
Yeah, so Apple or any company has to charge sales tax to people who buy things from them in any state where they have Nexus. And so Nexus is a presence, and the IRS and the state taxing authorities are actually even worse about it than the IRS. They have to, Nexus is anything. For example, of course, having an Apple store in your state is more than enough Nexus, but having one employee who works remotely and chooses to live in your state is considered Nexus by many states. And it's why we at Mac Observer have to pay California franchise taxes, because we have an employee, Brian Chaffin, who chooses to live in California. And, you know, I told the California State Taxing Authority, man, I don't care. If he called me tomorrow and said, look, Dave, I've been lying to you for the last 5 years. I've actually been living in Bolivia. I'd be like, well, that's fine. You get your work done. You know, whatever. I don't care where you live. You're on the Skype calls or the Google Hangouts every day. What? It doesn't matter. California's like, yeah, but it matters to us. So cough up the money, homie.
All right. I think the same thing happened. It made me very sad. So for a while, I was doing the Amazon affiliate program.
Yeah. And that Amazon killed it because of that, partially.
Well, they
of that.
Killed
yeah.
it because I think Connecticut wanted to force sales tax to be applied to those affiliate sales.
Correct.
And Amazon was like, Oh, too bad for you. Sorry you live in Connecticut. We're shutting down the program in your state. And I'm like, yeah, right. Thanks. Thanks for nothing, man.
All right. So so let's go with Andy here and see where this goes. Maybe we can keep it to 10 minutes. I hope so. So Andy says, Andy from London, maybe you'll come to the meetup on Tuesday. I came to the meetup this past Tuesday because of when this show's being released. I'll shoot Andy a note separately. I have a problem with my power line adapters. I have a pair of Solwise HomePlug AV2s, which are rated at 1200 megabits per second that connect my office on the first floor to the router on the ground floor. I have two machines in the office, a 2011 Mac Mini and a 5K iMac. The iMac connects to the router via Wi-Fi and the Mini goes over the power line adapter, essentially via Ethernet. First problem, I've tested the power line using iPerf on my laptop, connected to the router over Ethernet and then to the Mini over power line. With the iPerf client running on the Mini, I only get about 140 megabits per second over power line. The second problem, the connection to the Mini from the router keeps dropping for minutes at a time. I'm certain it must be power line causing this, though all the lights stay green when this happens. How do I know it's the power line and not the router? Well, I've attached a constant ping running on both, and sure enough, you can see the drops. So, and he asks, you know, what can I do? So here's the thing. I've used these gigabit power line adapters. Mostly, some of them are single stream, and some of them are multi-stream, kind of like our routers with, you know, single stream wireless or MIMO multi-stream. And indeed, some of these gigabit or even double gigabit power line adapters are multi-stream. They have a heat problem. So with regards to your connection going out, I've seen it here. When you're sending a lot of data, it can heat these things up and one or both of them will just stop transmitting data until they cool off a little bit. And the lights don't necessarily reflect that. I've seen this. I highly recommend using the single stream power line, and the 500 megabit per second units seem to be fat. My experience, well, if you're using the multi-stream stuff, you will see double the performance of whatever you see with the single stream stuff almost all the time. But even with the single stream stuff, there's no difference that I've experienced between the 500 and the 1000 or whatever they are. You getting 140 megabits per second in your home, you know, probably across multiple circuits, that's pretty fast for power line. You know, we were big fans of Powerline starting years and years ago, but our internet connections were only, you know, 20 megabits down, then 30 megabits down. Now that our internet connections are way faster than that, our internet connections for the most part are probably faster than what Powerline can do. You know, Powerline for me here tops out on a single stream, tops out at about 70 megabits. And on a double stream, it's the same as you're getting at 140, but it's not all that great. Again, it's an unreliable 140, which sounds like what you're seeing. So Powerline will work, but stick with the AV500 stuff. That seems to be the most reliable in terms of being consistent, and that's important. But if you want faster, those ActionTech bonded 2.0 Mocha adapters that I have and have been testing, man, these things scream. Even just a regular Mocha adapter, you're going to get, you know, hundreds of megabytes per second. And I've got really crappy, like, cable, like some of these ends that I have on my, you know, the jacks that I've got on my cables are junk that I made myself, and they're awful. And they still transmit at the maximum speed of Mocha 1, which is, you know, a couple hundred megabits per second, rather. My Mocha 2 stuff will go to like 400 or 500 megabits per second. And the bonded Mocha 2, again, starts using this MIMO thing, multiple channels at once. I'm getting over 800 megabits per second. So we're really close to gigabit speeds. Close enough that I said on the show a couple of weeks ago, I'm definitely going to have an electrician come and, you know, we're going to drill some holes and run some Ethernet cable. I am less inclined to do that now. It works really, really well. It doesn't interfere with our cable. If you have satellite, you're out of luck. the bonded Mocha 2 stuff, or maybe even any of the Mocha stuff won't work. But with cable, you know, I've got Comcast here. It's no problem. And wow, it's so good. It's so, I don't even think about it anymore. It just works. Plug it in and go. And I've got three of them plugged in three, you know, kind of remote locations of the house. No problem. All good. Yeah. And you can get a pair of those bonded things for less than $200. I'll find it on Amazon here, but, yeah, here it is. Action Tech bonded Mocha 2 Ethernet to coax adapter. $149. So it's even down from where it was, you know, for the two pack. $150. Good to go. I know. Huh. It's pretty awesome. I don't know. That's my feeling. What do you think, Mr. Braun?
Yeah. I'm doing the Wi-Fi.
Well, that's the other thing.
So I got to say, the one thing that you mentioned about those products that disappoints me, kind of like another product that I recently used that disappointed me, in that it, I would at the very least expect a device that is subject to overheating to kind of warn you.
Yeah.
When it's happening. Like, yeah. I've had this happen regularly when I'm using a GPS app in my car on my iPhone. Mostly, almost always. Yeah, it's only during the summer.
I was going to say, it's not the GPS app that's causing it to overheat. It's just the sun causing your iPhone to overheat.
Well, yeah, because I have a dark interior in my trusty 94 Saturn. What happens is that, and it only happens really during the summer, is the sunlight bounces off of the dash, and I have a car mount, and eventually so much heat comes off of the dash that it overheats the iPhone.
Right.
And it comes up with a little exclamation point saying, sorry, I'm too hot. I'm not working. And so what I do is typically I'll take it out of the mount. I'll remove the case. I'll put it, you know, on the, or what I should do is just run it without the case. And I think what I do is, yeah, I'll run the AC through the,
sure.
Through the defroster. And that usually gives me, that usually keeps the temperature low enough where it doesn't overheat. But yeah, that's, I mean, it's cool that you figured it out, that that's the problem, that it's just too hot. But you would think a little indicator would come on or something saying I'm over. I mean, even I got a shredder, you know, an office shredder. And even it has an overheat light. If I, like, you know, stressed it out, it would shut down and say, I'm too hot, man. Oh, yeah. Hold on a sec.
Yeah, hold on. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. But no, you know, you're totally right. And we've, of course, you know, that's the one topic that we didn't deep dive into today that we certainly could have and probably would have been arguably the most obvious one is routers. And we'll do one of those. Tell us what you thought, though, about this deep dive. But yeah, the router thing with Wi-Fi, it can be a great extension. We've talked a lot about that. In fact, we talked so much. That's why sort of why I avoided it. But I'm happy to do that again. Let us know what you thought about our little experiment here with deep diving. feedback@macgeekgab.com is where you can reach us if you want to. We'd like to hear from you.
Are you sure you got that right, Dave? I think you said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Yeah, I said it correctly this week. feedback@macgeekgab.com. Or premium at MacGeekGab.com. We'd love to hear from you there if you are a premium subscriber. And if you're not, obviously visit MacGeekGab.com. You can go to a link there to sign up. We would love your support if you're able. 224-888-GEEK, or for anyone who is not in the U.S., +1-224-888-GEEK. You can call or text us, and we would love to hear from you either way. So, you know, for anybody, feel free to text us there. We would love to hear it. John, what's geek?
I was going to say geek. I'll call you geek, Dave Geek, but geek is 4-3-3-5.
That's right. In fact, I don't think we've gotten, other than the text that you and I have sent as tests, I don't think we've gotten a text yet, at least not as of the moment we've recorded this. So I would love to for you to be one of the first to text us at that number, folks. So I'd love to hear from you. Facebook, our Facebook group is a great way to find us, MacGeekGab.com/Facebook, and also find us on Twitter at MacGeekGab over there, and that links to all the other Twitter accounts that we all have. It's all good stuff. I want to thank CacheFly at CacheFly.com for providing all of the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Of course, I want to thank our sponsors, including Gazelle, which was a sponsor for this show at gazelle.com. Smile Software at, or Smile, I should say, at smilesoftware.com/geek. Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG. Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com. Casper at casper.com/MGG, where coupon code MGG saves you $50. And barebones.com for barebones software. All right, John, you're the only one that's home right now. Maybe you're not home. Maybe you're out and about too. So do you have any advice for those of us that are most certainly not at home?
I don't know if I do have any advice here, but I'm going to assume, because this is kind of happening in the past, although you're listening to it in the present, and the future is probably going to come someday. But I'm assuming that if you're hearing this now, that Dave is back and he didn't get caught.
Actually, I'm not back yet. I won't be back for another week.
No.
I don't get back until the day before we do the next show.
Well, I'm hoping when you do come back, which will mean that you didn't get caught.
Made up.